from the Aromatic Studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another Epicurean Hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Are you unsure about how to handle this season's garlic harvest and this year's new planting? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll reveal the techniques that can make you a master garlic grower. Plus, we are joined by old friend Ron Ryle with an update on the Monarch situation, plus your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and uniformly ubiquitous undertakings. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up, like you having the best smelling kitchen in town.
WDIY has been broadcasting since 1995.
This is Mayor Ken Smith. Congratulations to WDIY for signing on the air.
We're with Commissioner Frank Donches of the Bethlehem Police Department.
We welcome Dr. John of the Blend today.
Bob Durow composed, conducted, and played much of the Schoolhouse Rock music.
Three is a magic number.
Weapon, the antidote to violence is to speak up against it.
WDIY, for 30 years.
From the brightly lit studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another flashing hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we recount an electrifying story of survival by Jason Bittle that appeared in a recent edition of the National Geographic called Even in Urban Areas, Some Lightning Bugs Continue to Shine. And we quote, for many people across the United States, summer doesn't truly begin until the soft glow of electric yellow and green fireflies can be seen drifting through the night. But you don't have to travel to the deep woods or open prairie to experience these otherworldly insects. In fact, several firefly species can be found quietly blinking in the heart of some of the U.S.'s biggest cities. It's the last place you would expect to see fireflies, says Shiram Morale, an international firefly specialist and National Geographic explorer. This summer, Murale traveled to New York City and Washington, D.C. to photograph urban fireflies as a way to show how resilient some species are in the face of one of their greatest threats, light pollution. Even in cities that never sleep, lightning bugs like the common eastern firefly have found a way to make do. Murale even discovered a rare population of the vulnerable dot-dash firefly lighting up the night during a photo shoot on Roosevelt Island in Washington, D.C. Also known as Big Dippers for the J-shaped flash pattern they make, common eastern fireflies are one of the most frequently spotted in U.S. cities, says Gabriel Willow, an urban naturalist living in Brooklyn. Willow says the best way for New Yorkers to see these bioluminescent beetles is to go looking in late June in Central Park's rolling greens and pollinator meadows, adding that they're pretty easy to find on warm nights as they go flashing and looking for a mate. Grassy areas are a particularly good place to look, he notes, unless the local government sprays for mosquitoes, which likely affects fireflies as well. McGrath barging in here. If those trucks are spraying old-school toxic pesticides, the mist will kill anything it touches. But many municipalities have switched to spraying BTI, a naturally occurring mosquito killer that only affects members of the fly family, which includes mosquitoes. Fireflies slash lightning bugs are neither flies nor true bugs. They're beetles and unaffected by the natural organisms in BTI. Back to National Geo, as someone who regularly conducts urban wildlife tours, Willow says he likes to remind people that many major cities sprouted up around areas that were once exceptionally biodiverse. He explains that New York City is located within an estuary, and that means you have lots of life. Los Angeles, he continues, was also built on a former wetland, and London and Paris are built on estuaries. And while the nation's capital is often described as being a swamp, it once really was just that, and its wetlands are home to an incredible diversity of wildlife, including fish, insects, and even newly arrived large predators like coyotes. But to find fireflies in a city, experts say, it's important to look for the dark corners where they have the best chance of surviving.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. In just a little bit, I will reveal the many secrets I've learned over the decades that lead to fabulous garlic harvest. From planting to harvesting and beyond. You won't want to miss it, and you won't if you stay tuned for this next phone call to 610-694-8100. Sydney, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thank you. Such a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Sydney. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Where are you?
I am in North Brunswick, New Jersey.
Oh, okay. Not that far from the Pennsylvania side of the river. What can we do you for?
So I've been having this issue with the Japanese beetles.
Mm-hmm.
So it started with just them coming on to my roses. And I thought it was fine just then. I tried to get rid of it by putting some of these, whatever you call it, 7 powder.
Oh,
then
Sydney,
they,
stop right there.
Then,
Sydney, 7
yes.
is S-E-V-I-N. And
yes.
they started an urban rumor that it meant that there were 7 natural ingredients in it. It is the most poisonous garden product you could handle. It doesn't belong anywhere, and it only exists because people don't care about selling poisons and promoting them. Do not use your 7 again. Especially don't touch it barehanded or breathe any in or anything like that. I mean, it's a super cancer causer.
I am shocked. Thank you. I should have contacted you earlier, I guess, because I put all of that on my rose plant, and I don't know, maybe I killed it, I guess.
Well, roses are pretty hardy. You're saying that after you spread the 7 dust, your roses died?
The plant is not doing that great, but it didn't cure the Japanese beetles problem either. So the Japanese beetles then went on to my other plants, the crepe myrtle, my other vegetables, my raspberry plant. So it's all over the place. No wonder they call them demons in the garden, I guess.
On your raspberry plants?
Yes.
I mean, they are famous for feasting on roses, but you're blowing my mind with raspberries. So, Japanese beetles are one member of the scarab beetle family. They came in with Asiatic beetles and other cousins, you know, in shipments of food and things like that, potted plants. And their life cycle is that after they're done ravaging your roses, the females will lay eggs in your soil nearby. The eggs will hatch underground, and little larvae will come out that burrow deeper in the ground to get below the frost line. As that frost line moves up, as the weather warms, they follow it. And now they're much larger, and they're feeding on the roots of your grass. So they're a double trouble insect. Your best bet, and you know, this isn't horribly well known now, but it should be pretty easy to find. I don't know if you've heard me talk about BT.
I have.
Yes, that's the genus name. For instance, the BTI, Israeliensis, it only affects mosquito larvae in water and prevents them from growing. There is a recently discovered, maybe 10 years ago, new strain of BT called BTG for Galleria, and it comes in two different forms. One, you spread on your lawn when the weather starts getting warm and they're feeding on your grass roots, and it will, as soon as they ingest a spore, it will kill them. But it won't harm anything else, and it'll even protect your grass because grass does not like its roots attacked like that. And then there is a spray form for the adults. This is almost unheard of, that the same substance can affect larvae and adults. But Japanese beetles are kind of unique in that they damage two completely different types of plants. So as soon as you see the first beetle anywhere, you would spray BTG on your plants and reapply it after rain. It is not a contact poison. Get it on the leaves, and when they eat the leaves, one spore gets in them, and the adult Japanese beetles die. Are you using Japanese beetle traps?
I try to, but then the Japanese beetles outnumber the number of traps, and I couldn't control it anymore. So
excellent. That's why. Excellent. Good observation. Very good. Because, yes, the traps do attract more beetles to munch on your roses than would be there without them. But what I recommend is you get one Japanese beetle trap, stake it in the ground, you know, comes with a stake and everything like that, and hang it up. And once the weather starts to warm, check it every day. When you find your first Japanese beetle in it, take it down, wrap it up in plastic bags, and you can either throw it out or keep it for use the following year, but get it out of the garden, because now you know that they're emerging, and this is the time to be ready with your BTG. There's really nothing you can do now. You're not seeing Japanese beetles now, are you?
They are still there, yeah.
Okay. For now, can you take a hose to where they are?
Yes, I can.
And do you have a nozzle with multiple settings?
Yes, I do.
Set it to laser beam focus and literally blast the beetles off the plants. Very few of them recovered. Most of them just lay down and die after that. And it's very satisfying. But always do this early in the morning, because you don't want your rose leaves to be wet overnight. And in the spring, be ready to treat your lawn with BTG. The only clue you need is that it's getting warm. And the warmer it gets, the more effective the BTG is going to be. And it's going to kill the larva before they can do a lot of damage to your lawn. And then be ready with the other, it is still the same substance, but they may come in two different forms. For all I know, it's a single powder that you can either dust your lawn with or mix with water. But you'll find that out. BTG for Japanese beetles. And it only affects scarab beetles and their larvae. So you may have Asiatic beetles out there doing damage overnight when you don't see them. But as long as you spray the plants throughout the worst of the Japanese beetle season, they won't be able to eat.
Okay.
All right.
So for this year, I just spray it with the water hose, and for next year, I spray the BTG on the lawn.
Yes, but a laser-sharp beam of water. You want a straight shot of water that kind of even hurts your hand when you put it in front of it. Not any kind of gentle spray or rain or anything like that. You're making a ray gun with water.
Got it.
And it's very satisfying.
Yes, it does. I do the same with the aphids.
Yes,
I took
exactly.
Your same suggestion for that as well.
Yes, exactly. You can also use a dustbuster to actually vacuum them up off your plants. You know, they sit there. They taunt you. They drop to the ground if you try to touch them. But if you come at them with some kind of a vacuum cleaner, they're just going to get sucked up, which is, again, also very satisfying.
Sounds good, Mike.
All right,
thank
man.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my yes. pleasure. And don't use that 7 again, but don't beat yourself up. There are entire hordes of marketers trying to convince you to use this stuff.
I will throw it out when I get home.
Okay, very good. All right, well, that's all we got.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Good luck. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there not to cut their lawns while those lawns are wet. Doing so would shred the blades of grass and lead to further soil compaction. But don't go returning that mower to the shed just yet, because we'll be right back with our very special guest, Ron Ryle, telling us about the state of monarchs this season, and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past 3 decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8000. 8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later, by popular request, that's right, a guy named Joe Popular requested it. I will walk you through what I do with my garlic from planting to harvesting and beyond. But right now, it's time for me to bring on my very special guest and dear friend, Ron Ryle, the king of butterfly habitats in Pottstown, PA. How are you doing today, Ron?
Hey, Mike. Well, a little warm, but I'm good.
Okay. You send out regular emails to a bunch of people like me, and you include some fabulous photographs. But the latest message I got from you is you've seen a confusing number and occurrence of butterflies in your yard, which is in Pennsylvania. I know you're most famous for monarchs because you raise them, you tag them, you're part of Monarch Watch. So tell me what's going on with this season's monarchs.
The monarchs are doing very well this season. They returned to Pennsylvania in the first week of May, very early. And we're seeing them every day, and the reports are coming in from my email list of about 200 folks. There's plenty of monarchs this year.
Now, run us through the life cycle again. I mean, we all know the egg to caterpillar to butterfly with the chrysalis in between. But what is their cycle in coming and going?
Well, every once in a while they'll come back in late April, maybe over in Chester County. But they come in May. Well, they actually leave Mexico in March. They overwinter as a butterfly for 7 months in Mexico.
Right.
Up in the mountains, 10,000 feet up. It's like a refrigerator. So it's like a hibernation process at that time. But then the third week of March, they fly to Texas, and they begin laying eggs on the milkweed, their host plant. So here in Pennsylvania, we have three native milkweeds. We have common milkweed, which they like the best, swamp milkweed, and we have the orange milkweed, Asclepias tuberosa, butterfly weed it's also called. So they begin laying eggs in May, actually. And this year, since they came back so early, we might even get a fourth generation. They've been saying there's three generations. Well, the monarchs in the summer live 4 to 6 weeks. That's all. The last batch, born in September usually, sometimes late August, they do not mate. They fly straight to Mexico. If they mate, they die here in Pennsylvania. So that last batch doesn't mate. And so that's they end up overwintering as a butterfly.
Now, you're saying they come in, they lay their eggs in May.
May. And that's the beginning.
And how long does it take those eggs to become a caterpillar?
You get a caterpillar in 4 days. You can't see it, though. It's like a hole in your milkweed.
Right.
It's a chemical reaction. And but on about the third day, you can see this itty-bitty caterpillar.
Huh. Because in reality, the caterpillars are quite big when they're grown up.
Yeah, I guess they're a little over an inch. Yeah, they're pretty big.
So now we have a caterpillar that's full of milkweed and other nutrients. How long after it emerges from the eggs does it start to spin a cocoon?
It takes usually about 10 days.
This is all wham bam.
It goes pretty fast, but the whole process, it's about 28 days. I mean, it takes a while.
And then I understand they emerge and they have to spend some time in the sun drying out their wings before they can fly.
Yeah, it takes 2 or 3 hours for the wings to dry.
And what happens now? How does the cycle get repeated? So we're still early in the season.
Yeah, this is early, actually.
With the first adult monarchs. Are they going to stay here and go through an entire cycle while they're still here?
Yeah, they're going to get through two more cycles yet. They're laying eggs now again. Some have already been born. Actually, quite a few. Reports coming in are pretty good. And so they're out there laying eggs again. The ones right now, they'll be born, let's see, yeah, August. So they're not going to Mexico.
No.
So we have another batch after that. That'll be the ones going to Mexico.
And about what time do they leave, or does it depend greatly on the weather?
It depends on daylight and temperature. But when the days get shorter, they know not to mate here, but to head to Mexico. So it's a very unique thing that they do.
So just to get it right again, so we got males and females overwintering up in a cold area of Mexico.
Yeah, Rosario is the biggest one, west of Mexico City.
And when do they mate, this batch?
March, in Texas.
In Texas?
Primarily.
Okay.
Yeah.
Everything goes through Texas? So they don't mate till they start flying. They fly and then mate.
Yes, they fly a little ways and then mate. They got to find that milkweed.
Right.
And I don't know if there's any milkweed in Mexico. I couldn't tell you, but...
Well, there must be something there.
There probably is some. It's never been talked about ever. Texas is where they go to begin that next brood of monarchs that come up here.
Although the way you say it, it seems logical that they would do all their mating in the States.
Well, they just know that last batch, they know not to mate and fly straight to Mexico and overwinter for 7 months as a butterfly. It's crazy.
What about the ones who don't make it, if you know what I mean, who are healthy and everything, but the timing didn't work out for them and they didn't have the right levels of sunlight to instinctively get them to fly?
That does happen, and then it's too cold and they're going to die here or wherever they're at. You know, wherever the cold weather is, they'll die there. But actually, two kids from Sassmansville, they found monarchs November 8th. Well, it was too late. So they shipped them to Texas in a cooler to their cousins, and then they let them loose out of the cooler. It's like if you go to a wedding, they keep the monarchs in envelopes in the refrigerator. So they called me up. I said, yeah, try to find somebody down south, and they did, and they shipped them in a cooler. It was neat.
That is. So if you're willing to put in a little bit of effort, these late crew can be saved.
Yeah, they can be.
And you are famous once again for capturing eggs, caterpillars, and adults, and raising the eggs and caterpillars by yourself, so to speak. Then hopefully you'll have a chance to tag them.
They did find one of my monarchs in Mexico, went 2,038 miles. They're dead when they find them. Some of them freeze to death up there.
Right.
It's cold up there. It's like a refrigerator, and they're piled up on top of each other about 3 feet out on these fir trees. So the ones on the outer edge, a lot of times they don't make it.
I have seen images of the ones closer to the center kind of trading places.
Yeah, they do that.
So it's a fascinating creature. I mean, everybody loves to see a monarch. And if they want to learn how to do what you do, which is catch and release, essentially, would you recommend Monarch Watch as the best advice?
Yes, monarchwatch.org is a great source for getting milkweed seeds, buying a butterfly net, buying the tags. They're the ones that have the tags for tagging, and they do all the research on the monarch butterfly. For the past 30-some years, they've been doing it.
It's almost sad that this happens during school vacations mostly, because this would be so much more informative than a beehive or anything.
Yes, that is sad. It doesn't coordinate with the schools.
Can't have everything. Now, in your latest roundup, you mentioned some very unusual butterflies and their timing. You want to run us through a few of the things that really surprised you this year?
Well, I'm up to 31 species I'm climbing now. And remember, I'm in the city here. It's an urban butterfly garden. I had a white M hair streak, which I usually see in September. I had a common sooty wing, which I usually see a lot later. I've already had a snout, the butterfly with a nose. And I had a viceroy that stayed here for an hour on the fruit. Eight butterflies prefer fruit, so we have a large fruit station where we have bananas, rotten bananas, fresh apples, and rotten apples.
Yeah, so I've heard
those,
that that's,
those butterflies were early for me.
I've heard that that's a great way to kind of erect a butterfly feeder.
Yes.
And I will again warn people, you can do one or the other, but you can't lure birds to your property and butterflies.
Well, you can do goldfinches.
Because they're too small to eat the butterflies.
Yeah, they go for the sunflower seeds and the giant hyssop seeds, the Mexican sunflower seeds, purple coneflower seeds. And my stuff's already going to seed. It's ridiculous.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you. I've been through a lot of crazy seasons, but this one, this is unimaginable.
Yeah, I've never had one like this. My Verbena bonariensis, which is the number one attractor, out of those 31 butterflies I've seen, about 20 of them have been on Verbena bonariensis. It's going to seed. I'm going to cut back half of it. It'll still flower some, even though it's going to seed, but not. It won't be as prolific. So I'm going to do a cutback, but that takes 2 weeks to get the new flowers. So I'm not going to cut back the whole thing. It's a little tricky.
One of the things you've always told me is, you know, one, you got to have milkweed, and you should find a milkweed that grows well in your specific region.
Yes.
But what you do is you just fill the room. I've been to your house. It is a single home, but a small one with a lot of others around it. And your backyard looks like a rainforest.
It's even worse this year. My Mexican sunflowers, I have three of them. They're 10 feet tall.
Whoa.
And that's I want that for September, but we're not in September.
Right, yeah, so everything is off track. How do you think that's going to affect the number of monarchs we see in the following years?
I think we're going to be all right. I can't think of any effects. Now, usually I grow 34 Mexican sunflowers. I have 48. Oh, my goodness.
Plants?
It's a nightmare.
48 and plants?
I planted them from seed directly into the soil.
Oh, goodness.
And a lot of them are 8 feet tall. If I get a windstorm, I'll be wiped out over here.
Yeah, but I'm sure you've got strength in numbers.
I stake some of them. I stake them, and I have backups. I have some little ones. And my wild ageratum, it's blooming already. No way. I'm going crazy over here.
Well, everybody I talk to is going crazy about what's happening in their gardens.
State Fair zinnia, 5 feet tall? Huh?
Yeah, well, it's been a punishing summer, but I guess at some points it's been a very rewarding summer.
Actually, that's true. It's a mixed bag.
Everything is. So you have two books out. Are they available to the public?
Yes, they are. One I did August of last year. It's called Pottstown Butterflies. It's a natural history journey through the backyard over 6,000 hours. It has 134 photos of butterflies, 20 photos of birds, and it has eight, some rare bees. I do a lot with bees with the Lycanthemum muticum, which was the plant of the year with the PPA this year.
Right.
There's some beetles in there. And that book, I think, is a collector's item. The photos are, they're very hard to get, and so you have 180 photos in that book. That one's expensive. It's $29.99. So the other book is the gardening book, second edition. First one was done 15 years ago. It tells you, it has the top 12 nectar plants, how to grow them, where to buy them. And I think there's 57 photos in that one. That one's very informative. Since it's a second edition, I tried to put more details in. The fruit-eating butterflies are discussed in depth. The fruit station that shows you a picture, how to do it. So that one is, if you're going to do a butterfly garden, that one's a good one.
And these books are available?
You can get these on Amazon directly from the publisher, and they actually ship for Amazon. And that's Masthoff, masthof.com.
Okay. Now, I want to add before I let you go that your photographs are fabulous.
Thank you.
They
that's a cheap
are,
camera.
They are natural. The Natural Geographic. I got to copyright that. they're equal to the photos I see in National Geographic.
I appreciate that, and that's done with a Canon 530 power shot.
Okay.
A lot of the photos, though, I'm 3 inches away. I get pretty friendly with the butterflies, so.
Oh, yeah, and you'll never tire me of pictures of native bees up close. So, once again, our guest has been the master of Pottstown butterflies, Ron Ryle. Now, it's pronounced Ryle, but spell it out for me.
It's spelled R-I-C-H-A-E-L, Ron R-I-C-H-A-E-L. So if you type that in with butterflies, you'll probably see the two books there.
Fabulous. Thank you for joining us today.
Enjoyed it, Mike.
And I look forward to stopping by your crazy garden of wonders.
Sounds good, Mike.
All right, you take care, pal.
Take it easy. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there who foolishly had wood mulch spread on their property this spring to keep an eye out for the nuisance fungi that breed in these pieces of trash wood, especially if hard-to-remove little black dots have been appearing on your house, cars, and children. But don't go yelling at your landscaper just yet, because we'll be right back with all you need to know about garlic and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. What are those little black pods that sometimes appear on the stalks of wild tiger lilies? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll reveal what lots of our alert listeners have taught me about these UFOs, unidentified fastened objects, plus your fabulous phone calls. So on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and yes, we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, I will reveal the many secrets I've learned over the decades that lead to fabulous garlic harvest. You won't want to miss it, and you won't, because it's coming up after a fabulous phone call to 610-694-8100. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm Joe from Cincinnati, Ohio. How's the ducky today?
Unhappy. It's like 100 degrees and dry. And when we did get rain, it was so fierce, we had multiple inches in less than an hour. Ducky couldn't go out because he would be out in the Chesapeake Bay by now or something. Anyway, what can we do for Joe in Cincinnati?
I'm following up on a question I had in the past about weeds and unwanted plants in my yard. And last time you said I should mow high, leave the clippings when I mow, which I do, mulch the clippings, and use a sharp blade. So I've done all that. I have my mower set as high as it'll go, and it says 4 on the mower, but when I measured the blades of grass, they were about 2.5 inches high, which I understand is below what you recommend. And the weeds are just
We're close.
Yeah, I'm close. So the weeds are just like one spot in my front yard. It's almost all crabgrass. I also have clover and chickweed and a few violets. So I don't know how to control those without chemicals.
Well, I don't try to control my violets. They're beautiful and the flowers are edible. So I pick those in the spring. And then even though they appear mostly on mounds, they pretty much disappear on their own after they're done flowering. Crabgrass, I'm trying to think of what that means. Crabgrass is a grass of choice, believe it or not, down south. But it's less prevalent in the north. I don't know what we call Cincinnati. What's your zone?
6. One of the 6s. I don't know if it's A or B.
Okay. Everybody's pretty much a 6, it seems. And there's no way you can raise that blade height.
It's as high as it'll go.
No, it's fine. Now, have you done anything to improve your lawn in the last 6-8 years?
No.
How long have you lived there?
6 years exactly in August.
See, somehow I knew that. I'm physic. So here's what I'm going to suggest. When people get into your situation, there is one cure that is bound to help and also will improve the general overall health of your lawn, and that is to have it core aerated, C-O-R-E, aerated. That means they come with a machine and they actually pull plugs of soil out of your lawn. And then you can rake them up and compost them, or a lot of people just leave them on the lawn to decompose. But by removing X amount of soil, that's making the soil around it looser. And if the compaction is handled properly, you may see a lot of what looks like damage right after they do it. And they should do it, by the way, right after the summer weather breaks. You know, early fall is a great time for a cool season lawn to recover. I presume you have a cool season lawn.
Yes.
So that is often an excellent cure. And depending on, you know, it might never have been done, right? So the soil pretty much has to be compressed. And that is one of the biggest factors in poor lawns, especially when somebody like you is doing otherwise all the right things. If you also want to go a little further, get a weed burner, a garden torch. It's a shepherd's hook. You screw a little bottle of propane in one end, and it has an electric igniter. You click that, and a flame comes out the other end. If you really want to reduce the amount of crabgrass, and you can do this anytime now, when especially during a hot and dry spell, just torch the plants. You don't have to remove them, but crabgrass spreads by dropping billions of seeds. It's only an annual. It would die naturally, but it seems to come back in the same place every year because it drops so much seed. So if you burn the seed right, you know, between now and, say, a month before you get your aeration done, you'll destroy most of those seeds. So,
and then plant grass?
Well, you can. You can plant grass, and if you are going to, fall is the time to do it. In order, you would burn, aerate, and then overseed or reseed.
So Okay.
But fall is the best time for all of that. Okay?
Okay.
All right, go out there and get them.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
As promised, it's time for the question of the week, which we are calling how to handle your garlic harvest and plant next year's crop. I post photos of my garlic harvest start to finish on the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page every year, and those photos always generate lots of questions. Joni G. writes, my garlic never gets very large. Adds Carol V, I don't have any luck with my garlic. What am I doing wrong? Okay, especially for Joni, it could be your timing. Depending on your location, single cloves of garlic should be planted in September, not October, in regions that get real winters, to allow more time for root growth before frost, which equates to bigger bulbs at harvest time. Another rule of thumb is to plant your cloves at least 2 months before any possibility of frost. Consult your local state extension service for recommended planting times in warmer areas. Another possibility is poor soil. Garlic grown on flat ground will never become as large as garlic grown in raised beds containing really loose soil. Adding a lot of perlite, a natural mined mineral, to your mix of compost and screen topsoil will further lighten the load and greatly improve drainage. We move on to Kevin B., who writes, please post your magic formula for processing your garlic. Well, let's begin with the harvest. When the bottom third of your plants start turning brown, in late June, early July in my garden, pick a test plant and pull it out of the ground. If it resists, water that spot, return in an hour, and pull gently at the base. If it still resists, gently dig around the base until you can pull it out. If the stalk snaps, dig that bulb up right away. Now, if your bulb looks like a big leek, it is not ready yet. Use that kind of leek to spice up your next dinner. All parts of the garlic plant are edible. If you can see it, you can eat it. Note, some people harvest the greens for an early treat in the spring. This won't hurt the plant, but will result in smaller heads at harvest time. If that bulb has a nice, fully developed paper wrapper, begin harvesting. Thickest stalks first. Let the thinner stalks grow some more. Ideally, harvest over a period of a few weeks, unless you start to see wrappers that are exposing cloves or splits in your heads. Then harvest the rest immediately and do not wash or refrigerate harvested garlic. Once harvested, garlic should be cured or dried. Immediately after each harvest, bring the plants to a spot that's not in direct sun. Do not dry them in the sun, as some unenlightened sources suggest. It cooks away a lot of the essential oils that make garlic garlic. I dry mine on a screen porch under a ceiling fan, turning the bulbs every day for about a week. Otherwise, dry the bulbs on wire racks and or point a household fan towards them. Once dry, I cut the stalks off, leaving around 4 inches attached to the bulb to keep the correct amount of moisture inside. This is also when you can gently brush the dirt off. Again, do not wash your garlic bulbs. Now examine your harvest and separate out the largest bulbs. You'll use their biggest cloves for replanting. Then separate out any smaller damaged bulbs and break them into individual cloves right away. Toss or compost any that have turned yellow and dry the rest in a food dehydrator, preferably on a porch if you don't absolutely love the smell of garlic. You can chop them up into smaller pieces for faster drying if you like. When the dried cloves snap rather than bend, dry them for one more day and then begin grinding them up in a dedicated coffee grinder that has never been used for coffee, just garlic, dried peppers, and the like. Have clean, dry spice jars with shaker tops ready. Start asking your family and friends for old, outdated ones that they'll never use. Put a few of those desiccating pouches that come packed with things like vitamins in the bottom. Then fill the jars with the powder that you have just freshly ground. Tighten the lid, and you will have, quote, put up the most amazing garlic powder possible. Hey, makes a great gift. Now is the time to decide what to do with the rest, because hardneck garlic, the type most people grow, does not store well, often sprouting as early as Thanksgiving. No worries. Plant these sprouted cloves outdoors, and they'll grow just as well as the unsprouted cloves you planted earlier. Hardneck varieties are the absolute best for growers who experience a cold winter. They're much more flavorful and colorful than softneck varieties, but they do not store for long periods of time. So plan to use anything you're not going to dry or replant in the months right after you harvest. Softneck garlic, aka California garlic or white garlic, are the best choice in warm winter climes. Once harvested and cured, they can last an entire season if kept dry, cool, and well ventilated. Softnecks are the ones you see braided and on display, but they lack the flavor and color of hardnecks. Warning, warning! A brief search revealed several, quote, influencers saying you can store garlic in the refrigerator. They are wrong. It destroys the flavor. Same goes for people who advise storing your garlic cloves in oil. Do not do it. The organisms that breed in the oil, including botulism, are incredibly dangerous. That sure was some hopefully helpful information about growing, harvesting, and processing your garlic. Now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure, or of course your leisure, by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to grab my garlic if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100 and follow the prompts to reach You Bet Your Garden. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Oh, and about those Gmails. Why are so few of you including your location when you contact us? Do you think we're up to something? I am not a bot. Of course, that's just what a bot would say, isn't it? And visit our Facebook page where we are always posting new photos of stuff that looks good in my garden, important and informative updates about the show, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive Question of the Week, and links to our priceless podcast, It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station, WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he swam from one side of a kiddie pool to the other without stopping. Our musical director is the unstoppable Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Northfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprote. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. Special thanks to our guest today, Ron Ryle, for discussing the state of butterflies and especially monarchs this crazy season. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be studying what's left of my seed packets for information that can help me decide what to plant now in my recently vacated garlic beds. At least until I can see you again next week.